So, our speaker really needs no introduction. However, I would like to say that I think of Bill McKibben as a great awakener. I think it's not an understatement to say he's become really an important conscience for our age. I could try to remember all of the facts about his biography, but instead I can make it simple by saying just think dozens. A dozen honorary degrees, a dozen books, including his first book, The End of Nature, written in 1989, which was really the first book to bring climate change to public consciousness at sort of our level. Bill is the founder of 350.org, a grassroots organization that has held or conducted at least 15,000 rallies, I believe, in numerous countries across the globe. And I am so honored and grateful to be able to welcome him to Hawthorne Valley and to introduce him to all of you, Bill McKibben.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. What a pleasure for me to get to be here on a gorgeous day. I feel a little guilty about making you all come even halfway inside on a day this pretty. First of all, a great pleasure to get to join the CLC on its quarter century celebration. I think there's really no more virtuous work on earth than land conservation. I get to be on the board of the Adirondack Land Trust and Conservancy because I've spent most of my life in the Adirondacks. And if there was ever any place in the world that offered proof of what conservation could accomplish, it's the Adirondacks, a place that 100 years ago was cut stem to stern, hardly a tree left. And now, thanks to the conservation instincts of the people of New York, you have to be a good silviculturalist to know that you're not in old growth forest across vast swaths of that grand park. And so it is something that's deep in my blood, that land conservation. And what a pleasure to be at this famous farm. I'd heard of it, of course, but never been here before. And what a sexy place it is to be in the store there and see that there's not just sauerkraut, but curried sauerkraut for sale. Yes, you know, that sort of marks the neat new world that we've moved into. And though it's usually my custom merely to depress people, I actually thought I might for once start on a happier note. I'll get to the gloomy stuff eventually, but since we're here, since we're at an occasion devoted to celebrating the hard work of people who've conserved, among other things, huge amounts of farmland, and since we're in one of the showpiece farms of the whole continent, let's take a minute and think, just sort of think about what a good thing it is that has happened in the last little while in this country. And though Hawthorne Farm has been here 40 years, it's the rare exception. It's really in the last 10 or 15 that we've seen this boom in local food that's really the most positive thing happening on our continent. Now, 10 or 12 years ago at Middlebury College, where I hang out a little bit, I taught a course on local food production that I think was the first course of its kind in an American college. And I think that because there was nothing to read, and there was no books that we could assign, with the exception, the incredible exception, of all the works of Wendell Berry. The one human being who kept alive the idea that people were for something other than consumption, and that history was not a one-way street, that it could in fact be reversed, and it makes me unbelievably happy always to reflect that he's lived long enough to see, I talked to him on the phone yesterday, in fact, and, lived long enough to see that vision coming true. Because now, you cannot get out of an American college without reading, you know, Michael Pollan three or four times. And that's remarkably good news, and it's having huge effect. We started at Middlebury, I'll never forget, starting the farm garden a dozen years ago. And it was a real fight. Well, not fight, but it took some convincing with the administration that this would be a useful thing to do. And I remember one of them, Dean, saying to me, we wouldn't want people to think that we were an ag school. I said, I don't think that's really a problem. You're not, you know, don't worry too much. But don't you think it's a little odd that you'll give people a degree here in every other kind of culture that there is, visual culture, dance culture, literature, everything else, and the only culture that you're neglecting is the oldest one of all, the agriculture that we depend on. And he was not impressed by that argument, but they've all been deeply impressed by the garden, and I'll tell you why. Once it went in, it became the absolute favorite place for the alumni to go visit when they came back for a reunion. And so it turns out to have been the cheapest development opportunity ever that showed up there. And now they're very, I don't have a cell phone, I'm sorry to tell you. Is the microphone causing a problem, Johnny? You want me to do without it?
No.
Okay. This is happening everywhere around this country. It's happening some places more and quicker, of course, in Columbia County and in Vermont and in Oregon and a few other places where it's sort of gotten quick traction, but it's happening everywhere. Farmers markets now for 15 years have been the fastest growing part of our food economy in this country. Some of them are enormous. There are people here probably have been to, say, Madison, Wisconsin on a Saturday morning. I've seen 100,000 people making the circuit of the state capitol at the biggest farmers market in the country. It's worth the visit just to see, you know. Here's the bottom line, and it's the single happiest statistic I know. Last year, the USDA said that for the first time in 150 years, there were more farms in America, not fewer. That most powerful of American demographic trends, the move away from the farm, the de-rural, that had come to an end. Well, there's nobody in this tent, and nobody's parents, and nobody's grandparents, and nobody's great-grandparents who ever lived in America where the number of farms was on the increase. And I can't think of any more promising sign for the future than that. And to see the speed with which it's starting to happen and to see the vigor with which people are joining in. Every year at Middlebury, there are, I don't know, now 10, 15 kids who, having spent $200,000 on their education, desire nothing more than to go grow garlic someplace, you know? And I try to stay away from their parents at commencement, but it's a... I think it's the best thing that could possibly be happening. It pleases me no end to see it underway. It really is the beautiful good news, and to be here in one of the places that was a cradle of that movement at a moment when it wasn't clear that it was ever going to be a movement, that's very exciting and a great honor for me. And what a pleasure to know that the Hawthorne Farm was a partner with the Conservancy right from the start. That's as much optimism as I can, you know. No, let me let me say that that's why it makes it all the harder to sort of step back and think a little bit about the one thing that can and will derail this new world that we're moving into, unless we're very, very, very urgent in our attention to it. And that's climate change. That's the physical destabilization of the planet that we depend on most of all for agriculture. I wrote the first book about global warming, as Martin said, 22 years ago, The End of Nature. We knew most of what we needed to know about climate change 22 years ago. We knew you burned coal, gas, and oil, you put carbon in the atmosphere. We knew the molecular structure of carbon-trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. The only thing we did not know 22 years ago was how fast it was all going to pinch. And being human, we hoped it would take a long while, because then it would be somebody else's problem to deal with, not ours. But the story of the last 20 years is it's pinching way harder and especially way faster than we would ever have thought. Let's just talk about the last year, all right? 2010 was the warmest year for which we have records on this planet. 19 nations set new all-time temperature records. Some of them were really off the charts. We were on the phone one day with our 350.org crew in Pakistan. And one of them, it was last July, now one of them said, "Hot here today," which I was surprised to hear him say, because it's normally hot in Pakistan in July, and you wouldn't remark on it. And he said, "No, it's really hot here today. We just set the new all-time Asia temperature record. It's 129 degrees. I was like, "Yeah, that is hot." When you have heat like that, things happen. Last summer, for the fourth year in a row, the Arctic melted at a, you know, insane pace. Both the Northwest and Northeast passages were open. There was a yacht race through territory that 10 years ago people thought no human being would ever be able to navigate. You saw the pictures from Russia of that incredible heat wave and drought. It had never been 100 degrees in 250 years of record keeping in Moscow. But it got above it 8 days at the beginning of August. Fires that filled the place with smoke.
Yes, that's
it. Maybe the most dramatic pictures came from Pakistan again, and the wild flooding there. To understand what's going on, you need to know just really the single most important physical fact probably of our century, which is that warm air holds more water vapor than cold air does. We've heated things up enough so far that the atmosphere, on average, is about 4% wetter than it was 40 years ago, which is a very, very, very large change in a basic physical parameter of the Earth. Change is not supposed to happen at that kind of speed and those kind of variables. That means that you get more evaporation and more drought in dry areas, but it means that once that water's up there, it's coming down someplace. And we've loaded the dice for deluge and downpour and flood. And in the last year, you know, one country after another has thrown snake eyes. And you've seen some of the pictures. Queensland in Australia underwater. You didn't see the, because they're, you know, not white people and they're not TV cameras, but you didn't see the same thing in Vietnam and Philippines and Sri Lanka, parts of Brazil, north of Rio. Just unbelievable mega flood events. The one in Pakistan was particularly amazing. There's an area up by the Khyber Pass that normally gets 3 feet of rain in a year. At the end of July, it got 12 feet of rain in a week. That's why the Indus River swelled to the point where it covered about a quarter of the country by the end of August. The Red Cross said a month or two ago that there were still 4 million people homeless from that flood. So, you know, I don't know what that is, 50 times the population of this county, still, you know, without a place to live. And of course, you can measure the effect of all these things most easily on their effect on agriculture. The world grain markets provide a kind of ongoing snapshot of what is happening in the planet's weather. And for the last year or so, they've been kind of flashing red. When Russia had that drought, the Kremlin got spooked and immediately stopped all grain export to the rest of the planet. Russia's the third biggest grain exporter in the world. In a normal year, the price of wheat and corn immediately went up 70-80%. It stayed there because we've had huge crop failure in Australia. There's an enormous drought underway right now in France and Germany that's depressing yields there. The price of corn and wheat are 70-80% higher than they used to be. Now for us, that's, you know, for consumers in this country, sort of a problem, but not that much of a problem, because when you buy, say, a box of cornflakes, you know, it's like you're paying way more for the box than for the corn. So, you know, the price of corn isn't the hugest variable in that equation. If you buy cornmeal every day to make tortillas for dinner, the price of them goes up 80%, well, that's a big problem. There are billions of people around the world eating less than they want to tonight because of that weather. And of course, most of them are in places that have done absolutely nothing to cause the problem in which we find ourselves. Your average peasant farmer in Pakistan does not have much of a carbon footprint. This is not their fault, but they are quickly suffering the effects. Not that we're immune. Look around our continent right at the moment. In the Southwest, Texas, Arizona, parts of New Mexico, parts of Oklahoma are suffering through a drought worse than the Dust Bowl years. There are big parts of that territory that haven't had significant rain since last July. That's why more of this country has burned by this date than any year in our history. Those huge fires in Texas, in Arizona, in New Mexico. It goes a little further east, and they've got just the opposite problem. Along the Mississippi and now the Missouri watersheds, they had record snowpack, because deluge and flood when the temperature is below 32 degrees is called a blizzard. And then this spring, they've had record rainfall in place after place after place, and the result is there's been more water than ever measured going down the Mississippi and now going down the Missouri. And levees breaking and farmland flooding, and so much rain that people had a hell of a hard time getting into the fields to plant. It's clear that harvests will be greatly reduced in the Midwest, just as they were wrecked in Texas, where the winter wheat crop just never came along. It was so dry. Even in this part of the world, it's been a tough spring. Vermont's seen more water than ever in its history. Lake Champlain, where we have records for 250 years, has been at the highest flood stage ever recorded, and it's been that way for 7 or 8 weeks, you know. There was one thunderstorm that sent more water down the Winooski River than any year since the Great Hurricane in 1927. And of course, all that makes it really hard. People haven't been able to get in their fields and plant. The most beautiful, the kind of Hawthorne farms of Vermont, is a place called the Innervale in Burlington, 120 acres in the center of the city that grows about 10% of the food for Burlington, a truly amazing spot. But it's called the Innervale because that's the old New England term for a floodplain, and it was underwater until, you know, a few weeks ago, so not much growing there this year. That's the point I want to make. Well, the first point I want to make is a scientific one. Here's the thing to bear in mind. Everything that I've described so far happens with an increase in the globe's temperature of 1 degree. That's what we've done so far. We've added about 0.75 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface of extra solar energy by trapping all that heat, okay? So that's 1 degree. The climatologists are quite robust in their consensus that unless we get our act together very fast, and by getting our act together, I mean getting off coal and gas and oil far faster than any government is thinking about it at the moment, unless we do that, we're looking at 4 or 5 degrees before the century is up. There is no reason to think that we can deal with that. Even just for the most basic agricultural reasons. Last year, researchers at Stanford and the University of Washington published a paper just calculating what would happen to grain yields. Forget the effects on water, forget anything else. Just the effect of those elevated temperatures, 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, on grain yields. Because that takes our major crops out of the range in which they're adapted to grow. And the rule of thumb they arrived at was that for every degree that we go up from here on in, we can expect a 10% reduction in grain yields, just from the temperature. So you do the math, 3 or 4 degrees, and then try to imagine what a world is like with 30 or 40% fewer calories on it. Try to imagine what development or peace or stability or anything else looks like on that kind of planet. And the tough news is that even those places that have done everything right are going to be in big trouble. You can have, and right here one does have, the most beautiful, local, resilient, time-tested farming system you could almost imagine. But you know what? If it rains for 30 days in a row, you're not growing anything at Hawthorne Farms, you're not growing anything anyplace else. That's the point. There's no way to escape off the planet that we're now changing in ways that are completely unprecedented. We're taking ourselves out of the Holocene, that 10,000-year period that undersaw the rise of civilization. We've left it now behind. Our temperature is well beyond what it was then, and the only question is how far beyond we're going to go, and that's going to be up to us. And so I guess the point I want to make here is all of us need to be doing two things. And one of them is the thing that you're all doing remarkably well, which is building great local, resilient economies of just the kind that we need. And they're great for so many reasons. They're more efficient and ecologically sound, and they also allow you to cope, at least to some degree, with the change that's coming. This farm will be a lot better off than a conventional industrial farm with a degree or two of temperature rise. But you have another job too, we all do, and that's our job as citizens to figure out how we're going to work at the national and the global level to staunch that flow of carbon into the atmosphere before it takes us into places that completely imperil the good work we're doing close to home. And I kind of wish that wasn't true. When I write now, most of the books that I've written recently are all about local economies and things. And I would love really nothing more than to stay home in Vermont and work on this kind of stuff. Work with my neighbors doing this kind of work. It's what I like the most. And I was home about 50 days last year, because if we don't figure out how to solve this thing globally, none of that's going to matter. That's the work I want to talk with you about for just a minute, because in its way, it's beginning to be hopeful too. It badly needs your help, and it shares certain characteristics with this kind of happy work that we're doing around farming and things. I'm not by nature an organizer or an activist. I'm a writer. Writers are sort of the opposite. We're kind of people who are self-selected to sit in our rooms and type. It's nice to be here with you, but it's not. I would really rather be home, that's how well. But at a certain point, I had figured out that writing about this stuff wasn't getting the job done that needed doing. We weren't making any progress. In fact, if you think about it on a national level, a 20-year bipartisan effort to accomplish absolutely nothing. And it has succeeded completely. And it reached its high point 6 or 8 weeks ago when the U.S. House of Representatives voted down by 60 votes a resolution that merely said that global warming was real. We're reaching the point where ideology is replacing physics and chemistry, and that's a very dangerous place to wander into, at least from a kind of practical Yankee sort of standpoint. It's a bad idea when you start believing your own nonsense, you know, and that's what we're beginning to do. I think I decided I wanted to do more than write when I came back from a trip to Bangladesh, one of my favorite places in the world, and a place I highly recommend, incredibly beautiful, quite crowded, 150 million people in an area the size of Wisconsin, so densely populated, but they feed themselves because it's some of the most fertile land on earth. It's the delta where the great sacred rivers of Asia, the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, come flowing down out of the Himalaya into the Bay of Bengal, and so there's always a beautiful, gentle flood and leaves behind. I mean, trees, you know, big around as that post are a year old, if that. The things just spring out of the ground, you know. Amazing to see. In trouble, as the climate warms, the Bay of Bengal is rising, those glaciers are dwindling, but when I was there, the trouble they were having was more acute than chronic. They had their first big outbreak of a disease called dengue fever, a mosquito-borne disease that's spreading like wildfire around the world because mosquitoes are spreading like wildfire. Mosquitoes really like the warm, wet world. I mean, if you were watching this planet from a great distance through a telescope and trying to figure out why we were changing our atmosphere, you could have a worse hypothesis than we had embarked on a kind of huge mosquito ranching operation and that this was our, you know, idea. They're having their first big outbreak of dengue. Lots of people were dying. It was all over the front of the newspaper because it was so scary. I was spending a lot of time in the slums, so eventually I got bit by the wrong mosquito. I was as sick as I've ever been, but you know, obviously I didn't die because I was strong and healthy going in. I remember going to the clinic, you know, ward, hospital ward, bigger than this tent, and there's people on cots just lying there shivering, people on the ground because there's not enough cots. And the most thing I remember thinking was, this is really unfair. When the UN tries to measure how much carbon each country in the world emits, the 150 million people in Bangladesh aren't even a rounding error in you can't get a number, okay? They're, you know, people don't drive, the bicycle rickshaw is the main means transit. Most people aren't connected to the electric grid, not their fault. The 4% of us in this country, because we've been putting CO2 in the atmosphere for so long, are responsible for about 40% of the greenhouse gases currently in the atmosphere, okay? And so when I came back to Vermont, I wanted to do, as I said, I sort of felt like time to do something, but I had no idea. I'm a writer, I live in the wood. I called up some of my writer friends in Vermont and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go up to the federal building in Burlington, you know, which is our main city, not that much of a city, but it's what we got. We like it. And we're going up to the federal building and we'll sit in on the steps and we'll get arrested and there'll be a little story in the paper and we will have done something. Okay. And all the writers, the three or four writers I was talking to, as clueless as I, oh, that sounds like a good plan. Let's do that. One of them called up to the police and said, what would happen if we carried out this intrepid stunt? And the police said, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want. So we recalibrated. I sent out emails to everybody I knew. So we're going to go for a walk. And we left a couple of weeks later. We left from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the mountain because he's sort of our patron saint, you know, and off we walked, and we walked for 5 days to Burlington. We slept in farm fields at night. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so I called up all the sort of Methodist mafia en route to make sure that there would be potluck suppers, the kind of Methodist sacrament would be available, you know, as we walked, and we got to Burlington, and there were 1,000 people marching, which in Vermont is actually, you know, except for UVM hockey games, that's about as many people as come to any one place at any one time. It was great, and it got all of our, this was 2006, so it got all our candidates for federal office to come meet with us down on the shore of Lake Champlain, this big rally. And then I just met with us. They signed this piece of cardboard we'd been carrying across the country that said if they won, they'd work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050. And then it wasn't just the Liberal Democrats. It wasn't just Bernie Sanders that signed on. You know, the woman who was running for the Republican nomination for Congress, you know, almost won the race. She'd said 2 months before she wasn't sure that global warming was real. More research needed to be done. Turned out that the more research that needed to be done was on the topic, how many people will walk across Vermont and ask me to change my mind, you know? And empirically, 1,000 was sufficient because she signed, and that was good. That's how it's supposed to work. The only bummer was opening the newspaper the next day and reading a story saying that 1,000 people was probably the largest demonstration about climate change that had yet taken place in the U.S. When I read that, I thought, no wonder we're getting nowhere. We've got this superstructure of a movement. We've got Al Gore, we've got scientists, we've got policy experts, we've got economists. We've got all the right answers. You know, everything you would need for a movement, the only part we've forgotten is the movement part. There's nothing there to give it any heft. And that's a problem because, of course, we're up against people with no answers about anything but all the heft in the world. The fossil fuel industry is the most profitable and hence most powerful industry that human beings have ever engaged in. ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay? And in our political system, that gives them a lot more power than they deserve. And hence, getting anything done about climate change is going to mean, I think, building the kind of movement large enough to take them on. So that's what we've been trying to do. The next spring, we sort of did the same thing, but on a national scale, just working with some kids at Middlebury. We managed to round up people in 1,400 places across the country in the spring of 2007, including here, for 1,400 rallies and demonstrations on the same day, and it was really good. And it convinced both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, then running for president, to endorse this 80% by 2050 goal. And we felt smug, you know, about what we were doing. But 6 weeks later, in the summer of 07, really things kicked in a bad way. That was the summer the Arctic really melted. I spent that summer getting phone calls from scientists I had known for a quarter century who'd always been sober and concerned, and now they were panicked. And they were saying, things are happening way faster than they're supposed to. This is bad. By the end of that summer, it was clear that, you know, not only were we not going to solve this one light bulb at a time, we weren't really going to do it one country at a time. We're going to have to do it one planet at a time if we were going to do it then. And it was also clear that what happened in 2050 was no longer of great practical interest. What happened in 2020 was what was going to count. Those were daunting things to realize. People don't organize globally for a reason. The globe is a very large place on which people insist stubbornly on speaking their own language, making it difficult to organize. So we were both horrified and somewhat thrilled to read a paper in January of 2008 from our greatest climatologist, Jim Hansen at NASA. He and his team put out a paper saying, we now know enough about carbon to know how much is too much. Any value for carbon greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's strong language for scientists to use, and it's stronger still when you know that right now the air we're breathing is about 390 parts per million CO2. We're already way too high. That's why the Arctic is melting, you know? It's a scary thing to realize that it's not a future threat, but a present crisis. But it also was a little bit thrilling because we suddenly realized that we had a number to work with. And the good thing about numbers, about Arabic numerals, is they cross those linguistic boundaries, you know. And maybe we could organize around the globe. It was good we had that advantage because we didn't have too much else. We had no money. There were seven kids, just graduated from Middlebury. Seven's a good number because there are seven continents, so each one of them took a continent and off we went to work. The guy who got the, you know, Antarctica also got the internet because it's sort of its own continent. And our organizing consisted of finding people like us around the world. Most places, those aren't environmental. It's just not a category that exists everywhere. But people working on food supply in their communities, people working on public health, people working on basic social justice and war and peace, on all the things that you're not going to have on a wrecked planet, on all the things that nobody can work on right now in Pakistan because they're just trying to get tarps over people's heads, you know. We told everybody the first day we'd sort of do our first big aim was to take a day in the fall of 2009, October 24th, and organize, try to get this number, kind of try to push it into the bloodstream of the planet. And we didn't know how well it would go. We didn't have, as I say, anything in the way of resources. We really still don't. But we'd done a lot of work. We'd done training camps in like Turkey for Central Asia and in the Caribbean, one in Johannesburg where we brought a couple of kids from pretty much every country in Africa down there. Most had never been on an airplane or anything, but there they were. And they were great organizers and they fanned out across the continent. We didn't hear much from them because you can't just basically Skype people all the time all over Africa. The internet's still pretty notional in a lot of places, but we knew they were working. And the eight of us had gathered down in Lower Manhattan at the office we borrowed the week before this day we'd set, trying to, you know, do all the last minute jobs, send out press releases and things. But we were just kind of waiting to see what would happen. We told people to kind of upload pictures, you know, the minute they had them. We got the sense that it might work 2 days early on October 22nd. We got a phone call from a 17-year-old girl that we'd worked with in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, Lily. She was on the phone and she was almost in tears. And she said, the government took away our permit for Saturday. Ethiopia, not such a nice government. We're doing this today before they can stop us, but we're so sorry. We don't mean to jump the gun. We don't want to spoil it for everybody. We'd so hope to do it at the same time as everybody else. And there are 15,000 kids right now out in the street chanting 350. So I was like, don't worry about the date. It's okay. And it was pretty great. The picture showed up a minute later, and for the next 48 hours, the pictures just flowed in. There were 5,100 of these demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN said it was the most widespread day of political activity in the planet's history. You can look at them. You can look at some of them on, you can look at thousands of them on our Flickr account if you're really, and many of them are extremely beautiful. But the thing to look at, if you do look at a few of them, it's interesting. It was important for me to see, among other things, that the trope about environmentalists being rich white people who've taken care of their other problems simply turns out not to be true. Most of the people we work with around the world are poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's what most of the world is made up of. And oddly enough, they're just as interested in the future as anybody else, maybe more so, because the future bears down harder on them than on those of us. It was really beautiful and really powerful, and a little effective. We got 6 weeks later to Copenhagen, to that big climate conference that was supposed to solve this problem once and for all. And we managed to convince 117 nations to sign on to this 350 target, which we were pretty proud of, you know, having come from nowhere to do it. But the problem was that they were the incorrect 117 nations. They were all the poor and vulnerable ones, and the real addicts, led by our own nation, were not yet willing to come to grips with this, and so the whole thing ended in a complete fizzle. And 6 months later, the U.S. Senate wouldn't even take a vote on the most tepid, moderate, mild climate change legislation you could imagine. A U.S. Senate at the time with 60 Democrats in it wouldn't even take a vote. They were so scared of the fossil fuel industry. I thought that this would be the might kill off this nascent movement in the cradle, but happily there were people made of sterner stuff than me, and last October we did another one of these days. This one we called the Work Party, and we had people all around the world gathered in communities, putting up solar panels or digging community gardens or laying out bike paths. There were 7,400 of them, these events, in every country on Earth except North Korea. And at the end of the day, people put down the hammer or the shovel or whatever, picked up the cell phone and called what they had. President, Prime Minister, Politburo, said, look, we're getting to work, what about you? It was the beginning of our recognition that we were going to have to really start. It wasn't enough merely to educate our leaders about what was going on. We were going to have to really start trying to be more politically aggressive. And it's a lesson we continue to try and figure out how to learn. There'll be another one of these great global days this September. And I hope that you all take part. It's September 24th, and we're calling it Moving Planet this time. And it's going to be a lot about mobility. And most of the world, it'll be built around bicycles. Because bicycles are part of the solution that we need, and because they're one of the very few things that both rich people and poor people use around the world. And so a really good way to express that kind of solidarity. It will be beautiful in all kinds of places, but it will not be enough. Enough is whatever it takes to sort of knock the fossil fuel industry off that perch of power. So we're trying other things too. This year in this country, one of the campaigns that we're running that's been going pretty well and pretty interesting is a campaign against what's the biggest fossil fuel front group in the whole country, a group called the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is not your local chamber. Our local Chamber of Commerce is, in our town, they run the Chili Festival. We like them. They're good, okay? U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a whole other beast. It claims it speaks for all of American business. That's what it says on their website. But they got more than half of their funding from 16 companies. They don't have to say who those companies are, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court. But it's not too hard to figure out, because they devote their time and energy to making sure that the planet heats up just as fast as it possibly could. And in the most direct terms, they filed a brief with the EPA last year saying, no need to regulate carbon, because if the planet warms, human beings will be able to adapt their behavior and physiology to deal with the warmer world. Not that there are 16 companies might wish to, adapt their business plan to deal with the wind and the sun, but that all of us should whatever, I don't even know what that means, grow gills, I don't know, do something to make their lives easier for them, it's bad. And so all across America, we're getting people to simply say, U.S. Chamber of Commerce doesn't speak for me. Now, we have a perfect example. Laura, you have that banner there someplace, right? Hold it up for a second so people can see. Laurie just showed me his thing from Fox Hill Farm. Okay, so there's the banner he made up, which looks good there on him, but it looks even better on this cow. Any one of you who owns a business, a farm, I know the kind of businesses that people own in Columbia County. There's farms, and there are, hedge funds and things, and whatever you own. We need you to make this same statement. To sign up, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce doesn't speak for me. We've got tiny businesses, and we've got Apple Computer, making that claim. Saying we're capitalist enough to be able to deal with the world, the world of solar power and wind power, we're nimble and adaptive. We don't need to be stuck with 19th century technology like coal forever. It's a good campaign. Again, it will not be enough by itself. There are lots and lots of things we have to do. Some of them are going to be more dramatic than others. In the next few days, we'll be issuing a call for some very civil disobedience in Washington as the summer goes on. Because the president has to decide this year whether or not to grant a permit for a pipeline that would run from the tar sands of Alberta down to Texas. Now, those tar sands in Alberta are the second biggest pool of carbon in the world after Saudi Arabia. If you could burn them all tomorrow, all the oil in there, if you somehow could just touch it off tomorrow, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, now at 390 parts per million, would overnight go up 200 parts per million. We'd be at 600, not at 350. You know? And so you'd think it'd be a no-brainer not to build this thing, but there's a lot of money behind it. And the State Department said they were inclined last year to grant this license. And so we'll send out a letter in the next few days from Wendell Berry, from me, from Jim Hansen, from some great Canadians too, Naomi Klein and David Suzuki, and from some of the great indigenous leaders whose lands those tar sands are on, and people like Tom Goldthwait saying, please come to Washington and help us remind that extremely promising young senator from Illinois that so many of us were so happy to see elect president, the guy who said at his nomination, said, with this nomination, we're at the moment when the rise of the oceans will begin to slow and the planet will begin to heal. Just remind him that those words require some real change if we're going to make them happen. Hopefully we can do it. Let me just finish by saying that I think these places that I've been going, both the farm, the wonderful farm stuff, and this kind of political work that we're trying to figure out how to do in sort of new ways, that they're connected in powerful fashions. And they're connected by the idea of community, which is the most important idea that we've got, and the thing that, well, I wrote a book some years ago called Deep Economy, and the reason I wrote it was because I saw a piece of survey data said that they ask Americans every year since the end of World War II, are you happy with your life? And the number of Americans who said, I'm very happy with my life, peaked in 1956 and went down, that was before I was born, and it went down steadily from there, which is very weird, because our standard of living has trebled over that period of time. If things work the way we're forever assured they work, we should not be becoming rich. But it was pretty clear from the data what it is that's going on, at least in large part. What it is that's going on is that we have much weaker connections with each other than we did 50 years ago. We spent those 50 or 60 years with our economy devoted to one project, really, and that project was building bigger houses farther apart from each other. And the result of that project was not only a lot of the ecological ruination that we face, but also that terrific decline in community that can be measured in very direct ways. The average American eats meals with friends, family, neighbors, half as often as 50 years ago. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of 50 years ago. Sitting where you are right now, if you'd been there 50 years ago, statistically, you would have had twice as many people with whom you were really close. That's a very big change for a social animal to undergo. There are not enough iPods on Earth to make up for it. It is our sadness. And it's one of the reasons that what's happening with food is so exciting. I told you that farmers markets were the fastest growing part of the food economy. That's very good for ecological reasons. The 5-mile tomato is a big improvement carbon-wise on the 2,000-mile tomato. It's good for culinary reasons. I traveled 2,000 miles this week. I know how I feel. That's how the tomato feels also. You know? Martin, you know, because you came on the red eye. You know, just imagine what you'd feel like were you a tomato. But the biggest reason that farmers markets are better, different, is because they're socially different. I was talking the other day with the wonderful college kids who are here from COFIT, figuring out how to build food co-ops on their college campuses this week, and who we wish enormous good luck to. And I was saying that one of the great things about co-ops and farmers markets is that they're different. A couple of years ago, a pair of sociologists followed shoppers, first around the supermarket, then around the farmers market. You all have been to the supermarket. You know how it works. You walk in, you fall into a light fluorescent trance. You visit the stations of the cross around the perimeter of the market. That's that one. They followed shoppers around the farmers market. On average, they were having 10 times as many conversations per visit. Not 10% more, 10 times more. Okay, and of course, the only sort of odd thing about it all is our pleasant idea that the farmer's market is a chic thing that we've invented someplace in Union Square. I mean, this is how, you know, all the world shopped for food until 70 years ago, and 70% of the world still does. You know, of course we like it. That's what we're evolved. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we were all, you know, happily sitting on the savanna picking lice out of each other's fur, you know? I mean, that's, you know, we're social animals. And the same thing is true of our political life. That's another way that we have to relearn how to make those connections. It's one of the reasons we set up 350.org the way we did, so that people in all around the world could do things with their neighbors in their local places that responded to their local ideas and concerns and events, but that also had a global and a national meaning, could be added together thanks to the power of the internet, which is one of the few interesting wild cards that we have. We only need to go to Washington on special occasions like this civil disobedience. We should be able to do most of the rest of this from where we live. I'm going to stop because I've rattled on too long. Were I a good organizer, I'd just stop right now. You know, because I'm a writer and feel constrained always to tell the truth as best I can, I will say there's no guarantee that any of this is going to work. There are scientists who think we have waited too long to get started. Clearly, we're not going to stop global warming. At best, we're going to keep it from getting worse than it has to get. Okay? It's going to be a difficult century. The question is, will it be a completely impossible one or not? There are political scientists who think all this is impossible and the odds are just too high, and so far they've been right. And I suppose if you were a betting person, you'd be wise to bet that we were going to lose, because we've been losing for 20 years, you know. But that's not really a bet you're allowed to make. And I don't think many of you would, because clearly you're the kind of people who are willing to sort of bet on the future in different ways. Or if not bet on it, then at least, or maybe even more, without knowing what the outcome will be, still get up and try to figure out what you can do to change those odds some, with no guarantee that it comes out okay. Because this is the biggest thing humans have ever stumbled into, and it's going to be the devil's own work getting out of it. It's going to be hard. It's always a great honor for me to be around the rest of the world, in rooms full of people in places like Bangladesh, where people are working very hard, even though they've caused none of the problem. And I'm always impressed by their willingness to work with me and with us. I'm not sure if I were a Bangladeshi, I'd have that generosity of spirit. I think I might see Westerners coming and just kind of shake my fist and curse and say, go away, you've caused enough problem for us. The fact that they're willing to be in solidarity with all of us always moves me. It's a great honor to be in this room, this tent, tonight. Because I know you guys have done a lot of work already, and I know you'll do a lot more on things close to home and on things in the larger world. Because I know you understand how linked they are. No guarantee that we'll win, but an absolute guarantee that we'll keep fighting side by side as long as it possibly can. Thank you all very much.